Civic Stage explores how social change happens and the new ideas and actions that people all over the world are using to solve very specific civic space challenges. This show is produced by the Innovation for Change team. Welcome, everyone, to another episode of our show, Civic Stage, How Civic Innovation Happens. I'm Cara Andrade, Innovation Specialist for Innovation for Change. This month, we're excited to bring you some stories from our Civic Innovator series. Civic innovators are people who are solving real-world problems in difficult situations. We'll be bringing you an intimate look at how everyday citizens make change happen and help to protect and expand civic space everywhere. Today's show focuses on creative sustainability and the imaginative and inventive ways that civil society organizations and their partners are seeking resources, funding, and other support for their work in often difficult circumstances. We'll be hearing about two examples during our show. To tell us their stories are Sean Shea, Director of Social Innovations Advisory. Sean is based in Guangzhou, China, and he's a member of the East Asia Hub. Welcome, Sean.
Great to be here.
We also have Ana Maria Esping. She's a coordinator at Impactia, and Juan Carlos Lozano, founder at Impactia. Both are based in Bogota, Colombia, and they're members of our LAC hub. That's the Latin America and Caribbean hub. Welcome, Ana Maria and Juan.
Hi, thank you so much for this invitation.
Thanks, everybody, for being here. For our listeners, if you have a question or a comment, there's lots of ways you can reach us. You can send us your question via Twitter. Our handle is at INNOV for change. That's INNOV, F-O-R, change, all one word. You can also comment on the Blog Talk show page, and that's blogtalkradio.com/civicstage. You can also go to the Civicus Facebook page, and that's C-I-V-I-C-U-S at Facebook. So let's dive into our show. Let me begin by congratulating all of you because your projects are winners of our innovation grants. Both of your projects are incredibly pioneering and creative, and they cut across sectors. I'll be asking you more about these projects, but I just wanted to congratulate you first for not just proposing them, but also finishing them. And it wasn't an easy task. Felicidades, as we would say in the LAC Hub.
Thank you, Cara. I mean, it's an honor and a privilege to carry out this project. I mean, it's something I've been thinking of for many years. I mean, I spent a lot of time being a fundraiser for NGOs. So, you know, I know the importance of this topic and the challenges that NGOs face in trying to find alternative sources of funding.
Yeah, and thanks a lot also. I think we have something, or I'm sure many things in common with John, but this, you just said it was our case as well, the fact that for some years we've also been wanting to go ahead with this project. We've been thinking around it. We've been thinking of how it could impact a lot of organizations and social entrepreneurs around the world. So we'll tell you a little bit more about it, but it was a very important experience, a very important milestone for us.
Great. Thank you. Now we're going to get into deep dive with each of your organizations and your projects. Sean, your project is called Building the Roadmap to Financial Sustainability for Rights-Based CSOs, or Civil Society Organizations in the Global South. And you're one of the earliest winners of the innovation grants. Can you talk about where the idea for your project came from? Like, be very concrete if you can, and connect it to the work that you're doing in East Asia through your organization.
Sure, Cara. So, you know, I I've been thinking about this topic for a number of years. I mean, again, I've worked for two NGOs, one based in Beijing and one based in Hong Kong. And for both organizations, I was, I played a primary role as the fundraiser. In the Beijing organization, I had started up a an organization and was responsible for growing that organization. In Hong Kong, I was the deputy director for operations and development for China Labor Bulletin, which was a quite mature labor organization, NGO, and had already acquired a number of large grants. But, you know, sustainability was always something that we were thinking about. And I was trying to find other ways to diversify our funding, especially to try to tap into the growing wealth that you were seeing in China and, of course, in Hong Kong. And I think that, you know, a lot of people have been talking about financial sustainability and about trying to leverage alternative sources of funding. But nobody really talked about concrete cases. Nobody talked about how organizations actually did it. What were the actual steps that they took, and what were the, you know, the challenges they faced, and what were some of the ways that they tried to address those challenges? Nobody talked about these sort of very concrete things. Nobody tried to look at it through a step-by-step process. So I thought that it was time to try to bring together cases that could be used as models to kind of both stimulate and inspire other NGOs to think about how to do this on a kind of just to, as a way to guide them, you know, step-by-step through this whole process. Because I think, you know, we should say at the very outset that this process of trying to change your funding and business model for CSOs or for NGOs is really a very challenging process. I mean, it's not easy and it shouldn't be underestimated. So I think that it's really important that we have show NGOs how this can occur, and to show that NGOs have actually succeeded in making that kind of transition and finding a kind of a pathway to financial sustainability, and also to show that there are many pathways, that that it's a very, you know, there are diverse pathways, that there's no one correct way.
Thanks, Sean. I like what you're saying about the diversity of coming up with different ways to sustain. And I know that from looking at your different case studies, there's a lot of really interesting ways people are doing it in your region. Now, while your project focused more on the research and helping to surface some of those creative strategies for sustaining, Ana Maria and Juan, your project, which is called the Project Writing Wizard, right? Is that correct? It's a Project Writing Wizard. It's a tool to increase fundraising for Latin American civil society. You took a different approach. Can you share with us where the idea for your project came from and how it connects in Pactia's work in the LAC region?
Sure, Cara, yes. Well, something we had been seeing very particularly among our users and also you know, from running different types of analysis on the ecosystem of NGOs and social entrepreneurs in the region, is the fact that a lot of the organizations were struggling with the whole system of grants that exists. And the main reason why the first step of where they were struggling was something that we addressed in the early years of Impactian, is, you know, the difficulty to, without the contacts or, you know, speaking English, getting to the information of who was offering a specific grant, that was a main limitation. But after we started working on that, when we understood that a lot of the projects or the organizations would never applied to those grant opportunities, to those funding possibilities, because they did not have a written, you know, document of what they actually wanted to get funded. And it's strange to say, but there seems to be something that you know, overall blocks them to get there. And when we started researching, we understood that it was not having a first version, because a first version of a project, of a written project. When you have a first version, we found there was a similar situation as to when you're looking for your first job. You know, like when you want to get employed, your first job is very, very strategic, because after your first job, you can, you know, have references, you can tell people that somebody else has already, you know, had an experience working with you, et cetera, et cetera. But before then, it gets very hard. Here, it's the same thing. Without a first draft of your project, of that concept note, it's very difficult even to go and ask somebody to take a look at it, to improve it, to ask an expert to do suggestions to it. So a lot of the, you know, empowerment processes were being blocked because you didn't have the first draft. So that's where we focused on. We focused on a totally scalable way to help anybody in the region who speaks Spanish to be able to have a first draft of the project, to have it in a format that is understandable, that and without the need of you having to pay yourself a master's degree. So we're talking about democratizing the possibility of sharing your ideas.
I like what you're saying about this first draft notion. I was able to pilot test it, and I've never been great at doing this, but like even I could actually get my first draft up, and so I could definitely see how useful it would be even to just get that first draft and get you started, right? Because I think a lot of people get intimidated by the whole grant writing process or proposal writing process. And incidentally, you might want to think about maybe calling it first draft. I know that you are still playing with the idea. I like that that name quite a bit. So I remember the seed for both of these projects taking root during the inter-regional retreat that we were all at in Almaty in Kazakhstan in 2018. And I was fortunate enough to see that what we call the idea life cycle, right? From when we were in the hallway, I remember, and you were both talking about, Sean, you were mentioning about, you know, getting together and creating this group of practitioners, right? Or like a community of practice. Kind of very research oriented around sustainability. And I know, I think Juan, at that point, you were also talking about the different ways that organizations were forming alliances with different kinds of funders, right? Private sector. And just really interesting topic that you were doing a workshop on. And so I'd like to really give you the space to talk about your process, right? Like, what is the process, the creative process you went through from the point at which these ideas were generated back in 2018 to you proposing it as this very concrete project?
I said, Kara, I mean, that, this has been a process that's occurred over a number of years. And I talked about how I've been thinking about this, you know, since I've been working for NGOs in China and Hong Kong and trying to raise money for them. I think, you know, the IRR in Almaty was really an important moment, because I felt like before that I'd always kind of hit a number of walls. I mean, I was thinking about diversifying, and I had occasionally come across somebody who, you know, had also been having the same idea, but generally the people who I worked with worked in a very traditional sort of NGO manner, right? They were used to writing grants to mostly international funders. And it was hard for them to kind of think outside of the box. And I think in Almaty, it was the first time that I really came across a group of people who really were thinking the same way I was. I mean, and Juan Carlos was one of those people. And that was very liberating. I mean, because, you know, then you begin to see, oh yeah, it's not just me thinking these strange thoughts. I mean, other people, you know, have these kind of crazy ideas as well. And maybe these ideas are maybe not as crazy as we think they are. You know, as we go through this process, I also came across other NGOs that were telling me they had actually started doing other fundraising in other ways. They had been actually quite creative. And I started to take notes of this. I started to realize that, in fact, there were more of these cases. There were more NGOs that had already started on this. They had already embarked on this whole process. And I said, gee, it's really a shame that we can't document this, because if other NGOs knew about this, maybe that would help them to start thinking, to think outside of the box. Maybe that would get them to look and say, you know, maybe there are other ways of doing this. Maybe there are other ways of raising funds other than the traditional grant writing. And this is not to say that grant writing isn't important. And I think that, you know, the impact is this idea of being able to create a first draft is very important. I remember when I was in, raising money, one of the first things I would do is I would write several concept notes for several different project ideas, because I knew that they would be very useful later on. But again, it's not easy for somebody just to be able to write that kind of concept note. So anyway, I think, you know, that's the kind of process that I went through. And I think that the IRI was kind of a galvanizing moment that, pushed me to go ahead with this project.
Great, thanks. Ana Maria and Juan, what's your creative process? And I'm going to add another little extra layer there that Sean brought up, which is like, what is actually making your idea also crazy or innovative, as it were, than other ideas that you've seen out there?
Well, thanks, Kara. I mean, before having Anna tell us all about the craziness of the process, because it was very interesting to see that the idea I related with was more at a conceptual, very in the stratosphere type of level. But then it was Anna and Jeronimo who actually brought it to life, and that process. Me being in Italy, then Anna being in Colombia, and Jeronimo being in Buenos Aires was very, very innovative and a lot of fun as well. But I think that in terms of the conceptualization, I must agree with Sean. It's it was very empowering to see that there was an environment where risk could be taken, and a group of people that was willing to take risks at different levels, and to support you on that, and to give you feedback on that. I think the funding, though, was very, very important for us. Wouldn't have been the same without the support that we also received in adding value to the idea in the different stages. And all in all, also getting back to Sean's idea, I think it was very important for the whole design process to understand that building the first draft of a project is no longer only important in the framework of applying to grants and democratizing the application process for grants, but also in making it simple for other types of audiences and sectors to be able to relate to the projects the NGOs and social entrepreneurs were building. I think there's a very big process that was very clear to me in the IRR, that is the need of bringing together all these new sectors of social impact and social enterprises and social and impact investing to the traditional grants and funders type of ecosystem. And we need tools. It was very clear to me after that we needed practical tools that could make it easier for those two worlds to communicate. And that's a bit of what also the where impact investing is gaining ground, where social enterprises are starting to do different types of work, where there's private actors that are coming in and saying, well, we want to cooperate, but we just don't understand the systems.
Oh no, we have a little bit of an interference in your connection. I think your internet's starting to drop out, but maybe Ana Maria, you could add something.
Okay, yeah, I can tell you about the process, the innovation in the process. So we had a lot of challenges. Juan Carlos already told us about the distance, and it was really hard. But what we did was using agile methodologies to solve problems. We created this tool rapidly because we had 8 weeks to do it. So we had different steps. First, we did research to understand the needs of our users, and it's been a long time doing this. We try to understand always our users' needs. But after that, we had a design phase, and it was hard because all of us had different ideas of what we wanted to be the final product of this. And we tried to understand what was best for our users, but it was really hard. The heart of this process was the design sprint. It's a methodology for solving problems through design and prototyping and testing our ideas. Testing was really important for us because we wanted to understand if what we were creating was being useful for them. Before spending all the money we had in development, we tested all we were doing in prototypes, in simple prototypes, so our users could give us feedback, and we did after that all the necessary changes to have the best tool. After that, we did a development phase, and our tech team did an amazing job, and we were able to develop this tool in a really short time. It was amazing.
Sean, do you want to add something about what makes your project innovative?
I think the project itself is maybe not that innovative. I mean, in terms of like, you know, we're just collecting models or cases. I mean, I think this is something that other NGOs certainly do as a way to sort of advocate for change. I thought what was innovative was the pathways that I was looking at. Seeing different NGOs take. And also what was innovative, you know, in the sense that, I mean, I think they were trying to think of different ways to sustain, to fund NGOs, again, outside of that traditional grant writing model, which I think is not easy to do. And I think another thing that was innovative is that, that you know, these NGOs, as one of the NGOs said to me, you know, it was being willing to fail. I mean, to fail through a kind of trial and error process. I mean, you know, they would try things. They weren't sure if it was going to work. And, you know, they were, as Juan Carlos said, they were taking risks. And to me, that is also part of the essence of innovation. So I think, you know, maybe those are some of the ways that I think of these as innovative.
Yeah, and Sean, you bring up a good point. Like, you know, things can be innovative in different ways. It doesn't have to be like the latest you know, gadget or application or technology or things that we usually think of as tech innovativeness, right? It can also be that you're being innovative in the way that you're solving a problem through a specific methodology or strategy, right? In this case, you were using research, right, as a way to help surface some ideas or ways that people were sustaining. So I think that in itself is valuable and innovative. One of the things that we focus on at Innovation for Change is specifically on the closing of civic spaces. So I have to ask this question, although you've all addressed it indirectly. Why is funding for CSOs and nonprofits and this whole area of sustainability for them, why is that important for the closing of civic space?
This is something that really is at the base of our last 18 months of work very, very much. We've been understanding after Almaty that, you know, funding in itself was not only important to make things happen, funding in itself had a much greater importance because it was the means to open up a lot of microphones. It was the means to reach out to people. It was the means to secure rights. And that gave a lot of more importance to our work because one thing is saying, well, yeah, this project could benefit a community, and that's also that's super important in itself. But a whole different aspect of it is, you know, we've always been hearing about the closing of civic space as something that is political, as something that comes from regimes or comes through regulations. But we don't often think about how there's a major closing of civic space because you don't have the resources to compete under equal terms with a lot of other actors and phenomena that are taking place. You know, nowadays, if you want to get a message across to society, you're not only competing with potentially a government or a government official that is opposing you. You're competing indirectly with huge brands that are all running to gain the attention of the public. And if you want to be good at that, you need to have the right resources. So we understood at the same time that civil society for many years had gotten used to working with low resources, and that was bad, because low resources for certain projects would often mean low probabilities of success. So, you know, the importance of sustainability has to do also with having the right tools so that a good idea has a high probability of success in itself.
Juan, thank you for joining us over the phone. You're back. Sean, go ahead.
Yeah, so, you know, I think this is an important, certainly, question. I mean, you know, why is access to funding so critical? And I think that, you know, over the years, I mean, we're talking about decades now, I think a certain kind of business model of the NGO has emerged. And that business model, again, is one where NGOs tend to survive for funding based on writing grants, mostly to international aid agencies or to international foundations, and this has become a kind of self-sustaining model until I think maybe the last 10 years. And in the last 10 years, I think that governments around the world have kind of caught on to this model. And as a result, they've begun passing laws that have made it more difficult for NGOs to get funding primarily from foreign sources. I think the International Center for Not-for-Profit Law has already, they've documented that there's been, I can't remember now what the exact number of it was, but maybe around 60 or 70 countries that have already passed laws that are restricting funding from foreign sources or foreign funded activities. I mean, China is probably one of the most recent that's joined this club. In 2016, China passed a foreign NGO law, which basically regulates all activity that any foreign NGO carries out in China, regardless of whether it's funding, it's holding workshops, it's holding conferences, it's you know, doing capacity building with partners in that country. All those things are regulated, and all foreign NGOs now have to register with the police in China to carry out those kinds of activities. So, and I also saw this in Israel when I went on a mission to look at access to funding to human rights organizations. In Israel, there is a conservative NGO called NGO Monitor. And this NGO it lobbies actively to advocate for European funders not to fund these human rights NGOs because they're supporting Palestinians, because they're supporting terrorism, and so forth. So there's a very active lobby in Israel to try to get foreign funders to close down funding to human rights organizations in Israel. So this is something that's a global phenomenon, and it's seriously affecting NGO's operations and is a major contributor to this closing civic space that we often hear about.
You know, we could do a whole show based on the two things that you both just said, because what I'm hearing, and this has come up in a lot of other circles, right, is this whole notion that Juan is talking about, which is the democratization and the leveling of the playing field as far as like funding and fundraising, right, for organizations of all sizes, right, because it's come down to capacity, right? And this is what you're saying, Sean, too, is you got these large organizations, which are basically the big fish that are able to get these large pots of money because they have the capacity and they have the size to be able to apply. But then the other thing that you're addressing as well, Sean, is this whole notion of the political aspects of funding, right? If you have international donors funding in certain areas, they do shape the agenda, what happens locally on the ground. And so this whole move, and this is one of the interesting things about your project as well, is this move towards localizing the access of financial resources and creating local markets is really incredibly fascinating, incredibly relevant. And it's something that I remember when I was living in Austin at the time, Austin, Texas, as it was growing, there's a big push there for people shopping, even just shopping in their local markets, right? Not shopping at big brand stores. And so that when you have things like, you know, recessions, local towns or certain municipalities just don't suffer as much, right? Because you're buying locally. And I think the same logic could apply for supporting CSOs or nonprofits in a local way. So it's maybe stay tuned. Maybe we'll do another show on that. I think it's an incredible topic to talk about. I know that it's pretty late in China, so I want to make sure to get to the last couple of questions that I have. As far as your projects, I know it's a success just that you finished it, because sometimes it's really hard, especially with the grants that we give, because they're intended for pilot testing or experimenting with the first instance or the first draft, as Juan calls it, of your project. And it's hard to get it done, right? Because when you get started with larger projects, you know, it's hard to just kind of just get them off the ground and do that first stage. So I'm wondering if you could talk about what you consider to be a success or something that makes you proud about your project, and you could talk about maybe some significant change that you saw or some kind of change that you've seen so far as a result of your project.
You know, first of all, I should say, like I think I said this already, that trying to embark on a new path, trying to find a new model for a new business model for your NGO, trying to find a new funding model, is extremely difficult. And I think, you know, one thing I'm proud of, I think, is that, you know, what we're trying to do is find models that will get people to take this seriously and see that, in fact, this is achievable. This is realistic, that it's not something that people just talk about, that NGOs have actually done this. And this is very important, because what I've found in the research is that in order for an NGO to move in this direction, it's really important for the leadership to understand the gravity of this and to kind of, you know, make this a top priority in the organization. If the leadership does not do that, then the NGO is not going to move in this direction. And I think I can speak from experience, because I kind of faced that resistance in the organizations that I worked in. I was like, you know, the person trying to push for thinking about creative ways to get funding, and everybody else was still kind of very comfortable taking grants. Another thing I was really, you know, I found was that, you know, grateful to find cases where some really interesting cases where NGOs have really taken creative ways to tap into local funding or to do their own sort of what I call self-funding in order, for example, you know, charging fees for services or starting a social enterprise. And in fact, one of my one of my findings was that China, which is the most, so I looked at different countries. I looked at China, I looked at Vietnam, I interviewed organizations in also Malaysia, Hong Kong, and Indonesia. So China was probably one of the most closed societies, and yet it had probably the most diverse range of fundraising. I mean, in terms of like different funding and business models. I mean, it really had the greatest range, and that also said something about, you know, the whole process, is that process and trying to find alternative funding also depends on the country context. Each country is very different. Each country, you know, there are different alternatives. I mean, in China, there just happened to be many more alternatives than you saw, like say in Vietnam. And Chinese NGOs took advantage of that. So, you know, that was very interesting. But again, to go back to some really interesting sort of models, I mean, some organizations were really creative in terms of they would register several different organizations. You know, they would register like they'd have their own NGO. Then they would have a company. They registered a company that they turned into a social enterprise. And they also registered like a foundation. So they had three different entities operating at the same time. You know, the foundation was raising money, the NGO was applying for grants, and then the social enterprise, for example, you know, what the oldest environmental NGO in China, Friends of Nature, started a nature school, and they took tuition from adults and children to attend nature classes to learn about the environment, the importance of environmental protection, and they were getting significant revenue from that. They were also doing crowdfunding. So the crowdfunding they did, they were able to use the crowdfunding to support their lawsuits. They were filing public interest lawsuits against companies, and they told me they couldn't get funding for it. Foundations don't usually give money to cover these kinds of lawsuits, but they were able to get the public to support those lawsuits. So, you know, to see these kinds of things take place is, I mean, especially in a place which is as close as China. I mean, I always tell people, yeah, there is a civil society in China, and people, you know, just don't believe me because, you know, they've heard the news that China is a very closed place. But to see that these things actually are happening is very gratifying. It's very, it's very empowering to see these things taking place. So those are just some of the things that I wanted to highlight.
Juan and Anna Maria, do you guys want to talk about what makes you proud about your project, like a proud parent?
Yeah, but before Anna Maria gets into that, also I have a challenge that I think I'd love to leave on top of the table here with Sean, because I think there's a common effort that we could work towards towards the future. And we were just participating in the Latin America's Venture Summit in Cartagena last week. And this is a summit around impact investing and social enterprise. Something that was very evident is the difficulty for impact investors to find the good projects. And one of the big limitations that they've been coming across is finding mature organizations that host the project. So something that came to my mind, and I leave it on top of the table so we can work on it, Sean, afterwards, hopefully. But, you know, why not document better why it is a better fit many times to invest in an intra-entrepreneurial activity within an NGO that already has know-how, that already has organizational structures, maybe than just a new project that is coming out of nowhere that maybe does not have all that infrastructure in place. I think documenting something like that would be brilliant. And I think this is something we could work on towards the future.
Love it. Ideas coming out of ideas.
I think it's a great idea, Juan Carlos. And one thing I do want to say is when I first started this project, I was a little bit worried that NGOs would not open up. I mean, so I interviewed NGO leaders, again, who were responsible for strategic decisions in their organization. And, you know, you want to, you start talking, you think, well, they talk to me about funding. I mean, about their, you know, their financial situation. You know, these are things that are more sort of sensitive internal matters that you think they might not be so open talking about. But in fact, I was really amazed that these NGO leaders were fine talking to me about this. They wanted to tell me about their stories. So I think this is great. I think, yeah, we should try to make these stories and these cases better known.
That's wonderful, guys. I really appreciate your brainstorming. I'm going to go ahead and write this down too, that along with the other podcast idea I had. Juan and Ana Maria, I think you were going to talk as well about something you're proud of from your project.
Sure. Okay, so something we're proud about is the team we chose to do this, because our project had a lot of tech involved, and there's not a lot of people outside this sector that knows how this works. So we wanted to find the best team to address this challenge. And we found it on Argentina. So all our ways of working had to change. We usually do meetings, presential meetings, and all this in our office, but they were in Argentina, and we were not able to have it here. So it was really hard, but we did it really good. And they did an amazing work. And we right now, we keep working with them. So we are really proud of that. Other thing I would like to talk about is people are already using the tool. Now, right now, I think we have more than 60 uploaded projects to the tool. And that makes us really, really proud.
Wow, that's incredible. And we'll go ahead and let you plug in at the end where people can go and keep testing the tool if you need other people to use it.
Sure.
I'm happy to be a returning visitor for that. I'm also glad you brought up, Ana Maria, the whole issue of like how you did this. The process is also very innovative because you used agile you know, processes. Can you just give, for the listeners who don't know what agile processes are, what is that?
Okay, so agile methodologies helps us to solve problems through creating tools or things rapidly. You basically promote continuous iteration of development and testing throughout the development lifecycle of the projects and products you want to develop. We basically use agile methodologies, but the heart of this is design sprint, in Impactia at least. And with design sprint, you can solve problems through design and prototype and test ideas, basically.
And anybody could use it, right? It's a methodology that's out there that anybody.
Yeah, there's a lot. There's a lot of documents, and there's even a book that helps you to understand the methodology to use it.
Great. I know it's being taught in the Central Asia Hub too, quite a bit for project management. So I'm glad that you brought it up. It's a very innovative way. To do things in the tech sector, people have been doing it, but not so much in civil society. Go ahead, Juan.
No, I just wanted to say that I think Ana is very humble when telling the story, but she usually runs the design sprints in person on a workshop with the people, you know, looking at each other in the same place. And this time she had the major challenge of organizing and running the design sprint with having me in Italy, like 7 hours ahead, having Jeronimo in Argentina, in Buenos Aires, 2 hours ahead of Bogota. We did it over the internet. We implemented, and she implemented, you know, the use of online dashboards, and we drew together. And so you know, all in all, agile in the end is also a way of thinking around problems and a way of thinking about how you solve them. And I think there's, you know, there's a lot of available technologies nowadays that, you know, are destroying barriers permanently. And we just need to be curious enough to use them and go for it.
This is wonderful. I would love if you would take me up on an invite to write up a blog post about this, because I think it would be incredibly helpful to the network to know how you did this, because a lot of the network is increasingly doing these decentralized groups, right? Some virtual, some online, some, you know, some in the same place. Like, and so I think it, you know, Ana Maria, if you would be interested in writing that up, we'd love to have that on our website. And we're a little bit over time as well, but I just have one, well, I have two short questions. I can't leave without asking. I know that there's things we're proud of, but there's also things we wish we had known, right? After we do projects. So I just want to give you the space to also talk about maybe a challenge or two that you wish that in hindsight you had had a little more information about that or had known before you started this project.
I think one of the key things we did struggle with was I think there were two things. One thing is that we were in the middle of a transition of understanding how we wanted to work and who we wanted to work in terms of tech development, and we simply didn't have a lot of time to set up the team how we wanted it to be, or with running the process. So I think we were very lucky, but at the same time we had to risk more than I usually like to risk in a project such as this, in selecting the people. I knew that Jeronimo, because I knew him from the past, was going to work out really well, but we did have to have like a jump of faith when choosing the tech team, and the fact that the tech team was in Argentina as well. So that is something that we did struggle, but at times you just need to trust your instinct as well and just go for it and take decisions quickly is many times much better than over-diagnosing and just taking too long on a decision. And I think the time frame facilitated or pushed us into that. A second thing was, finding other models, understanding if what we wanted to do was had already been done by somebody else or not. And I think I would have wanted to have had a lot of more information, a lot of more maybe research to understand how to structure, or let's say what other benchmarks we had to compare ourselves with in terms of the final product as well.
Thank you, Juan. I really appreciate that, especially the part about don't overthink it, right? Sean, something you wish you had known, and I'm shaking my head over here because I know with us, with particularly with your project, because you were one of the first innovation grants that heralded a new process for us to fund small grants. I know that it was also a learning curve in working with our own grants process. So I want to just say, like, I wish we had known our processes a little better, so it would have been a little bit easier for you as one of the first grantees. But I'll be transparent about that, and I'll let you also share what challenge or challenges you face and you wish you had known beforehand.
I guess it would have been nice to know that those issues that came up in the grants process. I think you said I was one of the earliest, but I think my project didn't actually get started until later because there were all these issues that came up.
Exactly. That's what you get for being an early adopter, Sean.
That's right. So I guess I was a path blazer in that sense. Yeah. I blazed the path. I was able to raise all the problems for up front. So, I mean,
and we thank you for that. Thank you for that.
So I think, not so much what I would have wanted to know, but I think I would have wanted more time to carry out this project because there were other really interesting cases that I didn't have a chance to, I didn't have time to bring together. But in any case, I think that in terms of what I've known, I mean, it was really, I was very lucky in some ways because I came across just by accident some things that I had wanted to know, but then I found out in the course of the research. For example, I found out that the Ford Foundation had a program which was getting their grantees to think about financial sustainability. It's a program called the BUILD program. And the Ford Foundation gives core funding to their grantees for a period, I think, of like 5 years. And in the process, and these organizations then are to need to think about creating a plan for sustainability. So because I found that out, the Ford Foundation people in China and in Indonesia were able to introduce me to the grantees that were actually testing out these different pathways. And it made me realize how important funders can be. That funders can be a part of the, they're an important part of the ecosystem for getting us to think outside of the box. I mean, you know, you can say that funders have also been part of the problem because, again, we kind of gotten stuck in this whole process about applying for grants, applying for, you know, you're submitting a concept note, and if that gets approved, then we write a full proposal and submit that and so forth. But I think that funders are important for also changing that ecosystem and changing the way that we think about it. And they, you know, they have that kind of leverage with NGOs to get them to think in different ways. So it was really good to sort of stumble across the Ford Foundation's program. And it was also great, I think, to know that there were other similar projects that were being carried out through Innovation for Change, not just in Asia. So my project was really collecting cases in the Asia Pacific, but in fact, that there were other projects going on, for example, in Africa. So I think WACSI, the West African Civil Society Institute, they were creating their own sort of guidebook to alternative funding in West Africa. And I remember like Charles of WACSI, he kept like, you know, sending all his stuff onto the WhatsApp group. And to me, that was like, oh my gosh, you know, he's doing all this and I've got to catch up. I mean, it was kind of a, you know, he was really kind of getting me to move faster, but he was also giving me additional information and additional ideas and also encouraging me to carry out mine, because I was then aware that there were similar initiatives that were being done in other parts of the world. And since then, I found out, again, I guess I think there's been discussions in South Asia, in MENA. And I'm also working with Ed Rakash of the Rights Co-Lab, and he's got a similar initiative going on to try to gather cases. And many of his cases are from like Eastern Europe and Russia. So what we're doing is we're really seeing that this kind of push towards financial sustainability, alternative funding models, is truly a global affair. It's truly a global, you know, initiative.
Great, thanks. And I have, you know, what all of you are bringing up is the importance of collaboration. And I think it's one of the things that the network really helps with, right? Whether it's, you know, nudging us along in our ideas, but also connecting us. I think the value of collaboration for innovation is incredibly important. So I have one last question for all of you. And I know that while your projects are featured in our innovation gallery, you people can go there at Innovation for Change or the innovation area. Each of you has a specific card there for your various projects, and all the grantees have that, and both of you have that as well. I do want to give you a chance to get listeners more plugged into the work that you're doing. So how can they get involved once they hear this amazing show? How can listeners get involved with your projects and support what your organizations are doing, what this project, the next phase of this project is, or any other projects that you're working on?
So in terms of us, number one invitation we would like to address to all of you is come on to impactia.com. I think we can attach the URL to this podcast, open up a free account and start exploring with the information. I think it's very valuable for us that you use the information. We're uploading information on grant and funding possibilities on a daily basis. And so far this year, we've identified a bit over $5 billion. So A, we want as many people as possible to interact and use that information. B, help us, you know, further develop the project Writing Wizard. Use it. The more you use it, and unfortunately so far we have it in Spanish, but the more people use it, the more we'll be able to understand, you know, what are the further steps. This is a first milestone for us. We want to continue developing this tool into even more advanced and sophisticated forms. So send us your feedback, use it, and tell us what your experience was and how we can improve.
Great. Sean?
Yeah, so, you know, I was just thinking that it would be great to certainly collaborate with other people on trying to create tools for helping NGOs navigate this whole process. And I think, you know, Impactia with what they're doing is a great model for that. I mean, you know, simple, trying to create simple tools that the NGOs can use. You know, certainly for, you know, the alternative funding, trying to create alternative funding streams, trying to start a social enterprise, trying to think about crowdfunding, thinking about charging fees for services. These kinds of things, there could be, I think, tools created to help NGOs walk through this process. I mean, I'd like to myself create like a toolkit to help train NGOs and I think other stakeholders in the ecosystem. I mean, I mentioned funders is an important one. I mean, so, you know, to do workshops on this, because I think that, again, it's not easy to change this ecosystem. And I think we're just at the beginning. And I think we need to kind of create a social movement, if you will, in that direction. But to do that, I think we need different people to, you know, to help out, if they, you know, want to take part in hosting a workshop on this, I mean, I'd be glad to, you know, take part in that. If they want to help develop a tool for, you know, helping the NGO develop a new funding stream, I mean, that would be great as well. So I think there's many different ways that that people could help and collaborate in pushing this initiative forward.
Yeah, and I like that we have a whole list of projects for homework for all of us to work on it. And, you know, I can also think of the value of translating the first draft wizard to Mandarin, maybe to English, right? And maybe attaching that to your toolkit, Sean, be kind of an interesting exercise. And that's what I feel like with the network, that's the value of doing these kinds of conversations as well, is that you can cross-pollinate and then maybe even come up with a draft of doing something like that. So, well, that's it for our show. We'd like to thank our guests, Ana Maria, Juan Carlos, and Sean. Really special thanks to Sean for staying up late in China to record the show. Thank you all. You can say thanks, guys.
Thank you.
We'll do it one more time from the top, guys. All right. Well, that's it, everybody. That's our show. We'd like to thank our guests, Ana Maria, Juan Carlos, and Sean. Special thanks to Sean for staying up late in China to record the show.
Thank you.
Thank you. It was really great to be here. Thanks, and thanks, Sean, for staying up so late, and hope to see you soon.
It was great to be on the same show with Juan Carlos and Ana, and it was too... I'm sorry I didn't get to see you at the IRR, and you too, Kara, so... But great to see you in this meeting.
Well, we really appreciate you all taking the time and also for the knowledge that you've shared. To our listeners, if you missed part of the show, don't worry. The full show will be up on the Civic Stage show page and blogtalkradio.com/civicstage. You can also go to innovationforchange.net. If you have a suggestion for a show or any comments, please do post on those channels. And you can also email me at Cara@innovationforchange.net. For Civic Stage, how social change happens. This is Cara Andrade. Thanks again for joining us. And until next time.